Good morning. Well, it's finally here.
I am from the No Homework Party. I promise that if you vote for me, there'll be no homework.
No homework! No homework!
I'm running for the PE Party. We want PE every day, not just once a week.
Yay! I'm running for the No Uniform Party. If I am elected, I will make sure we can wear whatever we want to school.
We at the Colouring Every Day Party will make sure that colouring is the main subject in school from now on.
Colouring number one always. They were the students from the Glenbeg National School in Dungarvan, County Waterford, from News Today, courtesy of the Tuberty Show yesterday. Enough said. You know what you need to do. Manco Magan is a travel writer and he spent most of his life crisscrossing the globe.
How many flights do you reckon you've done in your lifetime?
You do all those sort of the annual flights when you're young, maybe going to France to learn French or going to German. And then my first big...
What age are you?
I'm 49.
Right.
49. Yeah. So I started travelling out when you do a few flights, one a year when you're young, from your 12, 13, 14. That was fine. And then at the age of 19, I went off to Africa and it just like changed my life. I saw the world was so much bigger. And ever since I've been flying. So for then 2 years, I went to South America back and forth every year. Then I went to India, all over India. Then after that, I went back to South America, then up to Canada, working there. And then I started making television documentaries for Travel Channel and for TG Car. So that would be every year, multiple flights, going to the Middle East. It was an overland trip to the Middle East, but of course you're flying there, flying back. Then through China, all over China for 3 months, making TV series there. Then Greenland. There's basically, very few places I haven't been.
Ooh, lucky man. However, Mangon has now made the decision to stop flying due to a mixture of guilt and, guilt.
For the likes of me, I can't understand climate change. I can't understand that whole carbon thing. I don't have the scientific wherewithal. But if they're saying that, and then if I'm thinking, what is like a quarter of my job is travel journalism, I am just promoting more flights. So in 10 years' time, am I going to look back? Like when some of these dire predictions that people are saying will happen, if they do happen, am I going to look back and say, I know I was on every single medium I could telling people to fly. Did I have that guilt, that original sin of all that extra carbon that I had polluted the sky with.
And in fairness to Moncon Air Miles McGann, he fully acknowledges the whiff of double standards at play and the complexity of the situation.
I'm not going to start proselytising, telling people not to fly. It's just because it's not my place.
But you told people to fly.
Yeah, I totally did. Because I had a passion. I wanted people to fly. And I just think it'd be too arrogant of me without the facts. I mean, I suppose we have to trust the scientists. It's weird what we're having to do now. Scientists are telling us this thing that we don't understand. But we have to take their word. So I won't fly. And in fact, that's not true. There's one reason though I would still fly for. I have this little theatrical show, this little thing, a Ron Exim, about the Irish language. I think I would put that on a plane to America to bring it.
Right. So the Irish language is more important than the planet.
Which, again, it is irrational. Yeah. Exactly. But yeah, I would make that decision. It's so...
Like, I've spoken to a lot of people about this. Mm-hmm. And although it's laudable what you're doing, it's minuscule.
Yeah, it's irrelevant.
Laudable but minuscule, yes.
Every few months there's new airports being opened in India and in China. They're going to have the biggest impact. And let's say even if it did have an impact, then what, the tourists, like I've mainly written about community tourism in Africa, a wonderful venture that helps local people. Or let's say the Irish tourist industry. That's all basically wiped out if my vision comes real.
But you see, here's the thing. It's like we've had our fun. You've had your fun.
Yeah, totally.
You've seen the world.
I know. And now I'm telling people not to. It's so
hypocritical. Imagine if somebody, and we don't have a lot of them, but imagine there's an 18-year-old listening to you now. Mm-hmm. There's a man on the radio who's nearly 50, ancient.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's been all over the world and he's telling me not to fly now. Well, he's suggesting that I don't fly. He's guilting me into not flying.
Indirectly. It's a real passive aggressive thing I'm doing. Yeah, yeah. If only I had the guts to tell people not to fly. No, because actually what I would do, if I had my way, what I would do is, clearly we should continue to allow flying for things like, diplomacy, for politics, for health, for emergency relief, for probably education, to spread enlightened education, cutting edge education between countries. And also, I would love that there was an allowance for young people to fly. But, I'm not, thank God I'm not the minister.
An allowance for young people
to fly. Yeah, so that they could do 4 or 5 flights, to get that experience of the world.
However, texters got in touch and they seemed less than eager to applaud Moncon for his decision.
I might be cynical, but easy to quit when you've been there and done that. That's what I was saying to you. You've had your fun.
Right.
I read your article, but you have been environmentally aware for years. Appreciate your decision, but easy enough one to make, says Liz. And yes, great, Ray. And will we stop all the tourists flying into Ireland? This is crazy stuff and dangerous to our economy, says Bodging in Killarney. He has seen the world and now he says stop flying. Well, you're not saying that. You're saying that you're doing it, but you're guilting the rest of us into stopping flying. Geraldine says, easy for Moncon. Do as I say, not as I have done.
I'm so hypocritical.
Well, you're not really.
Like, my hands are filthy. No, you know, I have promoted so many people to go abroad.
Moncon McGann with Ray going to sail and rail into the future. But back when flying was the preserve of the few, what are the essentials you'd bring with you on a plane journey? No, not you, Moncon, you're taking the train. But on Sunday, Brendan O'Connor spoke to Rachel Lysett, producer of the new TV series Her Story, about Ireland's trailblazing women. And she spoke about pioneering pilot, Limerick woman, Lady Mary Heath.
So she was the first person ever, male or female, to fly a plane from South Africa to London. So this was over 10,000 miles. This is in a wooden and canvas plane, in a single cockpit plane. She had two seats in it, but the second seat she had filled with extra fuel tanks, obviously, but also, interestingly, chocolates, novels, Parisian silk gowns, yes, yeah, and a tennis racket, which I never really fully understood.
Fair play to
but
her, yeah.
She was pretty incredible woman, and she was an absolutely incredible, just magnificently skilled pilot, because at this point there was no Coast Guard, there was no ground support, there was no Google Maps, there was nothing at all, there was no air traffic control. She was literally tearing pages out of atlases and going, that looks like Mount Kenya over there. I'll just steer to the left a bit. And when she reached the second highest mountain range in Africa, she realised she wasn't going to make it. The plane was too heavy. So she had to throw overboard many of her precious gowns and the tennis rackets and novels and everything. She did, yeah. And her makeup and all of it had to go over. So, and she cleared the mountain range by 20 feet. And she landed into Croydon to an absolute hero's welcome 3 months after she had set off, in May 1928. She landed and she was on the newspaper headlines all over the world.
But it was the 20s, so Lady Mary's top-notch navigational and improvisation skills were not enough to earn her an actual job flying.
And I believe women were just about allowed to fly a plane, but not if there was anyone else in it, is it? Not if there was a real person in
She was the first woman in Britain and Ireland to get her commercial pilot's licence, and she was the first woman to get a civil pilot's licence. And this was the thing about, oh my God, a woman will be flying our plane. So KLM said, we'll let you, because she basically, when they were all saying, oh no, you can't fly with people, you know, you can't fly, she went on to break loads of speed records. She reached huge altitude records. She did this huge flight that nobody had ever thought was even possible, you know, 10,000 miles across, you know, basically nowhere land, where if she went down, that was it, she was gone. She did all her own maintenance, all the rest of it, to prove to them that she could do this, which clearly she could. But when it was announced in the press that she was going to be taking a flying trial with KLM, there was huge public outrage, and she was just really horrified and pretty heartbroken, because this was her dream, you know, that she was going to be able to earn her own living, to earn her own money working as a pilot. It's something that she was so overly qualified to do, and it's just that people weren't ready for it. So she went to America and took part in loads of flying circuses and aerobatics and all of that, and unfortunately ended up in a terrible accident and had a brain injury and everything. But she was just unbelievable.
Quite a sad end for Lady Mary Heath, but what a life well lived. That was producer Rachel Lysett from Her Story speaking to Brendan O'Connor on Sunday. The number of people in mainland China now known to have died from the coronavirus outbreak has risen to more than 636, with confirmed cases of infection now over 31,000. The city at the epicentre of the virus is Wuhan, and Mayo native Michael McGreal is living in Wuhan, and he spoke to Sean O'Rourke on Thursday about life in the city.
How are you passing the time, Michael?
Cleaning. You know, when you get into a situation like this, a few things happen. And I thought it was just me, but we have a group chat here in China, and a lot of the other people are also experiencing this. A few things happen to you when you're put into quarantine house for 14 days. One thing that sets in is a slight depression through the repetitive nature of every day. Every day doing the exact same thing. You know, the second thing that sets in is a slight OCD, because you do have to go outside sometimes to top up with supplies. And when you come home, you're so worried that you're carrying the virus into your house that you have to clean everything. You have to wash your clothes, take a shower, wash your hair, wash your hands in alcohol. Then you have to Dettol your whole house. So if you do go outside, it's not as simple as putting on clothes, washing, and heading outside. When you come home, you have to clean your whole house from top to bottom. And you're worried about viruses in the air conditioner system. We're worried about bats and, you know, viruses on the floor. So you have to clean. And that's really most of the day is spent wiping down the house, studying up on Chinese and watching movies.
Now, Michael's wife is Chinese and his father also works in Wuhan, so Michael isn't willing to leave the country. But with the city on lockdown, tensions are rising.
It's very interesting being stuck in a city that's quarantined like this, because you witness the breakdown of society in such a way that you're only used to seeing on a movie. Like, I used to watch movies like Contagion and zombie movies and all these type of movies, and you could sort of see in these movies how society would break down. And I always considered that fiction, but I don't anymore. I've seen it firsthand of how society slowly breaks down in a situation like this, in a city that's quarantined. There's mass panic buying going on. It's impossible to get fresh vegetables in Wuhan at the moment. And if you do have fresh if there are fresh vegetables, you've got to be willing to maybe fight a little bit for it. You know, you have to move quickly. I've seen people here fighting over a carrot. It's not really a very good situation. But now the government has come in and they've stabilized the pricing. And they've said that if any supermarket or pharmacy is caught inflating food or rising price of food, there'll be heavily fined. But really that doesn't matter, because there's very little food around the place to buy.
However, Sean O'Rourke wants to probe Michael's analysis a little deeper.
It's obviously not a normal situation we're in, but is it fair to describe it as a breakdown in society?
In a certain way it would be. When I describe it as a breakdown in society, I mean, all manners are gone out the window now. There's no more waiting in line. Everyone wants to be first. Everyone will put themselves first in a situation like this. And it shows through daily activities outside. It shows in supermarkets, people arguing, short-tempered, shouting at one another. It shows in pharmacies and just the daily life now. If I go to walk outside, people are scared of each other. If I'm walking down the street, people are scared of me. They're going to walk across the street to the other side of the street to keep away from me. So in that regard, yeah. But as for looting, rioting, everything like that, no.
Mayo native Michael McGreal, now living in Wuhan and speaking to Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. Ludwig van Beethoven is having a birthday. In Ronan Collins' terms, he's having a roundy birthday, 250th to be exact. Dave Fanning spoke to conductor David Brophy about the composer, but it being 2FM, Dave was keeping it poptastic.
Is he the greatest musician ever, David Brophy?
I can't. I'm not going to say that. That's a trap. You're going to lead me down a cul-de-sac. I'm not going to say that. But he certainly was a key person in the development of music.
Can I take a look at some pieces, first of all, before we get into the man and try to put him somewhere? I mean, you know, I'm going to say Beethoven is jazz. Why am I saying that, and what is this piece? We're going to take it through other pieces of music, in other words.
Well, maybe it's better that I'll just play the music first, because the music speaks for itself, I think.
Oh, right. Oh, wow. David's going all kind of weird on this today. Okay.
True, though. Jesus. Thank you.
Do you know, you mentioned the two words Joplin and Scott a few minutes ago. God, I can see it all, yeah, right. Yeah. So tell me about that. What are we talking about here?
That's the last part of his very last piano sonata, written about maybe 6-7 years before he died, written in, I think, 1820. And he was completely deaf when he wrote that. So he'd gone profoundly deaf. His deafness started from the mid-20s and he was deaf by the age of 44.
By the mid-20s, you mean his age, mid-20s?
His mid-20s. About 26, he started going deaf. And so he wrote that when he was completely deaf. That was written at a time when we hadn't a clue about swing, right, or jazz or funky stuff. And it just sounds to me, every time I listen to it, I go, how did he write that? Then, like, where, in the 1820s, where did that come from? You know, like,
you've just asked the question. Where did that come from?
It just came from,
like,
him.
Did he spend a few days in New Orleans or something?
New Orleans, no. I don't know where it came from, but there's something in that. You kind of listen to that and go, God, that guy was 100 years ahead.
The two Davids, Brophy and Fanning, wishing Ludwig van a happy birthday. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Tuesday, Ray Darcy spoke to two parents, Faye and Elaine. Both have children with autism. Faye has two children, Saoirse and Patrick, and she talked about managing family life and Patrick's autism.
The worst day of my life with Patrick's autism was in March last year, and my husband is a huge rugby fan, and once a year he goes away with two of his brothers to see a Six Nations game away. That's their blowout weekend. And earlier on in the year, Mick and I, my husband, were taking our eldest daughter, Saoirse, down to Clare overnight to go and do a course down there for siblings of children with autism. And Patrick had got really upset and it got very violent towards me. He'd hit me in the face with the kitchen bin and then tipped the rubbish all over my head once we told him we were going away. So we decided if Mick was going away, we would try and maybe defer his attention a little bit or distract him a little bit by taking him away. So we planned to go down to Enniscrone for two nights. Myself, Patrick and the girls, and my mum and dad were coming with us. And that morning, Mick had left because it was an early flight, and our dog, Heidi, came charging into the bedroom. She'd normally be let out in the morning, but Patrick went and let her into the house. She came charging into the bedroom, weed all over my bed. So I jumped up out the bed, ran out and got stuff to clear it up. And in that time, Saoirse started screaming because Saoirse had slept in the bed with me the night before, and we have a wooden sleigh bed. And Patrick had broken into a locked cupboard where we keep all our dangerous things, and he'd got a cookery blowtorch and he was trying to set fire to the bed. And Saoirse was asleep in the bed. And she jumped out the bed and he started to try and burn her with the blowtorch. So I just leant across the bed, dragged her across the bed and got her out and told her to get her sister and phone her granddad. And then Patrick tried to burn himself.
Right.
Ray also spoke to Elaine. She has two children, Kirsty and Logan, and they both have a diagnosis of autism. And it's the lack of verbal communication that she finds incredibly distressing.
I would say I never underestimate how sad it is to have a house of small children that don't talk. That's the thing that still gets me and Kirsty's age. Not here now, her words are slowly but surely coming. I mean, things have been drilled into her for a long time. So if I say, you know, say mama, she'll make an attempt to say mama, and they are coming, but she's 8. Logan is 6 and he doesn't have any words. We've never heard mom, dad, hi, Kirsty, nothing. So I'm at home with them, but when my husband comes in, I, like, you know, I make a motor mouth because I don't talk to anyone. Yes. That's the incredibly sad thing about having children that are nonverbal. You don't get to hear all the things that you assume you will. And things can be very, very tough for Logan. He can get really, really aggressive and really frustrated. Like, he can be quite violent. We've had a lot of kind of bouts of violence with him already because he's so severe. The worst day of our life was about a year ago when Logan, when he's frustrated, he'll punch or he'll kick or he'll bite, and he'll get his knee and kind of drive his knee up into his forehead. So when he's upset, we can put him into the front room or into the therapy swing. You have to maintain a distance because he'll hurt you as well. But obviously I have to stay near to stop him hurting himself. And he gave himself a black eye, just punched himself so hard that his eye was, like, that was kind of rock bottom for me. That was when we got him looked at again and got him reassessed. But he's so young for me to be dealing with the violence already. And we've been dealing with it since he was about 4, that I really do struggle with. Not even 9 or 10 or 11, just, like, what about when he's 15, 16?
Yeah.
Elaine Healy and Faye Hayden with Ray Darcy. Stateside, it wasn't a good week for the Democrats. In fact, the word shambles might be used. It started off badly and, frankly, didn't get a lot better. The Iowa Democratic Caucus is seen as crucial when it comes to selecting a Democratic candidate to run in the next presidential election against Donald Trump. However, it was a bad case of computer says no. Here's CNN reporter Donnie O'Sullivan as heard on Drive Time.
And it's a simple phone app that has caused all of this confusion.
Yeah, so there was about 1,600 precinct locations, so about 1,600 locations where people were gathering to caucus last night. And the idea was that the people who were running each event, each caucus, put in the results into this smartphone app, which was designed for the Iowa Democratic Party, which I think they paid about $60,000 for. I was in Iowa over the weekend, and there was some talk that there was concern that people, you know, might not be able to use this app, that they hadn't, it's a brand new app, that people hadn't had sufficient training on it. And last night it started to become pretty clear. Now, the Iowa Democratic Party and the DNC told us that, you know, we do have a hotline, a backup where people can call in the votes. But what was happening was so many people were having trouble using this smartphone app that then the hotline started getting backed up. So people, you know, were waiting more than an hour in some cases. You know, it's really extraordinary when you think of all the build-up here over the past year to Iowa. Yeah. And for this now to happen, it's beyond belief.
Yeah, it's a mess. It's embarrassing. Red faces all round. And the mobile app, I presume, will now go the way of the voting machines that were introduced in Ireland back in 2002.
Ooh, less conspiracy than pure simple cock-up. But Mary Wilson, as always, asked the pithy question.
If there is to be a bounce from all of this, who's going to benefit?
Trump. You know, I think this
good
really
answer.
Plays into...
Well, the next day was time for President Trump's State of the Union address. And Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan spoke on Wednesday's Morning Ireland. And frankly, there seemed to be very few grown-ups on the Hill.
Well, look, we know there's no love lost between Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi. They've had very public rows. They haven't spoken in months, and there was absolutely no hiding that tension last night. As Donald Trump arrived at the podium, he handed Nancy Pelosi a copy of his speech. She extended her hand, but he did not shake it, and he turned away. Then at the end of the address, Nancy Pelosi very deliberately and very obviously ripped up her copy of the president's speech. Afterwards, she told reporters that she did it because it was a manifesto of mistruths. And of course, the State of the Union address is that big annual speech given by the US president when he gets to highlight all of his achievements, and it is particularly important in an election year. Donald Trump last night hit all of the buzzwords for his base. He spoke about abortion, gun rights, illegal immigration, healthcare. And of course, there was lots of references to the most important thing Donald Trump is banking on for his re-election, a booming American economy.
And the week did not end there for President Trump. He was, as expected, acquitted on all impeachment charges. But rather than this making the Donald triumphant, here he sounds rather put upon.
We've been going through this now for over 3 years. It was evil. It was corrupt. It was dirty cops. It was leakers and liars. And this should never, ever happen to another president, ever. I don't know that other presidents would have been able to take it. Some people said no, they wouldn't have. But I can tell you, at a minimum, you have to focus on this because it can get away very quickly. No matter who you have with you, it can get away very quickly.
From Thursday's Drive Time, and earlier that day, Marion McKeown had joined Sean O'Rourke and described the toxic atmosphere in Washington.
Honestly, Sean, I spent a lot of time in the Senate while all these hearings were going on, and I sat there and I watched, and it was quite distressing, and you couldn't see it on TV, to observe the contempt that so many Republican senators, and I have to say one or two Democrats as well, showed for the proceedings, the passing of those, the whispering, the smirking and grimacing. Say Donald Trump has emerged stronger. The Democrats have proved no advantage that I can see. This is open war on Capitol Hill at the moment. The atmosphere is just poisonous.
Marion McKeown with Sean O'Rourke on Thursday. But there seem to be very few things that the leader of the free world doesn't have an opinion on.
The Make Dishwashers Great Again movement isn't as crazy as it sounds, according to the Daily Telegraph. It tells us Donald Trump is furious about dishwashers. At a rally last month, he rallied against worthless new models that give you so little water that they need to be used 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 times to achieve a proper clean.
Oliver Callan sitting in for Ryan Tuberty on Monday, but it prompted Oliver to this throwaway remark.
I mean, the thing that kind of would excite me about dishwashers is whether you're a forks down or forks upward kind of person. I'm forks down.
Well, prepare thyself, gentle listener, for the floodgates they did open. Election, schmlection, piffle. This is something the people could really get exercised about.
David says, forks up, knives down. What are you, a monster? Now, that's different rules for different types of cutlery. No, that's everything goes down, face down.
Face down, sir. It's all a bit Full Metal Jacket, but that was Monday. And on Tuesday, well, the text just kept on coming.
The dishwasher wars continue. Kathy tells us she has a dishwasher which is a cutlery tray on top. It is the best thing ever. Walter in Dunboyne. There are usually 8 sections in the cutlery tray in dishwashers. I have a system of putting knives in 2 sections, forks in 2, large spoons in 2, then 1 section exclusively for small spoons and the other section for large knives and so on. All the cutlery facing down, which is after me. But that's a lot of order. And he wants to patent his idea.
Good man, Walter, ask not what your country can do for you and all that. But all of this white goods chatter seeped into Wednesday when wine returned with a tip for the washing machine.
Get a dishwasher tablet. I'm doing this as soon as I go home. A dishwasher tablet. Put it into an empty washing machine and run it on a hot cycle. People who tried it said within minutes the machines were filled with dirty brown water. That is your filth. Your filth. Up there, all those jumpers and socks and jocks and everything else just fills up brown water. And those using the tip said they have never seen so much dirt taken out of a machine than with this little trick. So I'm going to try it. I shall report back. And I know that you'll be hanging on every word.
Breath and baited, but Ryan kept us hanging on until yesterday.
Are you going to fill us in on how you got on with the tablet and the washing machine? Myself and Nolene are waiting for news since Tuesday. Regards, Anthony. Well, isn't it a charmed life you have that you can afford to be waiting for news. Do you know what? I'm not going to lie to you. I did it. Now, what I didn't do was I meant to look at the door of the thing with the water in it to see was it all manky. I didn't. I walked away, got caught up watching Trump and came back and it was spotless. But I couldn't tell was it spotless or not. But I tell you one thing. When I put in another wash this morning, I know they're going in to more cleanliness. So psychologically, I was happy with that, Nolene. Anthony, the pair of you. Okay, but I should have watched the water.
Well, luckily, Ryan, listeners out there were staring at their machines, so you didn't have to.
Sanobert says, I just tried the dishwasher tablet in the washing machine, and now I'm watching a pool of dirty grey water while writing this. Wow, it's an amazing tip for a clean machine. Another says, I'm standing here like a fool watching my washing machine with the dishwasher tablet in it, and all I can see is suds. I'm not sure what colour the water is. Oh, it'll come. Wait for it. It'll be wonderful. It'll be wonderful. I tried the dishwasher tablets to clean my washing machine, horrified when I saw the dirty brown water whirling around inside. Everybody should try this. Oh, what fun! That's your weekend sorted out. Who needs an election when you could be sitting there watching your washing machine going round and round like the windmills in your mind?
Well, that's my Saturday night sorted. Back in a cycle. Welcome back.
Sport and elections. What a weekend ahead. Des Cahill's here.
Ireland versus Wales all weekend long.
Indeed it is. So how are we going to do against Wales, particularly in light of our performance against Scotland last weekend? Well, Des put that to Donal Lenehan.
As always, everything happens up front. As we know, Ireland conceded 2 scrum penalties. I thought their line-out maul was poor, but most of all, it was in the contact area. I mean, Scotland won the physical battle, and that is something that Ireland have to address, especially, Des, in the context that we're talking about a potentially horrific day weather-wise with wind and rain. That means there's going to be more spill ball. I think the scrum becomes more important from that perspective. I was interested to see Wayne Pivek has already engaged with Elaine Roland, yeah, who's head of refereeing with World Rugby. They were disappointed about 1 or 2 penalties that they conceded against Italy last week. So I think the scrum is going to be huge in this game. Interestingly for me, Romain Pott, the French referee, he's taking charge, and he has always been a referee who sort of makes his mind up early as to who has the dominant scrum and tends to support that team throughout the match. So I think it's really important that Ireland paint a positive scrummaging picture in the first 2 or 3 scrums in the game. I think given the potential weather conditions, this is going to be a key area.
Donal Lenehan with Des on yesterday's Morning Ireland, asking for a positive scrummaging picture. I confess I don't really know what that means, but go Ireland. And the women, of course, are playing on Sunday. On Lifeline this week, a lot of callers wanted to talk to Joe about crime. Audrey and Mary phoned in from Saggart in County Kildare.
Well, I, for one, know elderly people that are actually barricading themselves into their houses. They are not sleeping And they are also, you know, not going out at times because they're afraid of attack. You know, even my own father who walks the dog, you know, he won't go out late at night like he used to anymore for fear of an attack.
But is it... If it's exaggerated, people will live in fear. Are you exaggerating, Audrey?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. No, I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't speak like this if there wasn't a cause for concern. And there's a massive cause for concern.
Let me go back to Mary. Mary, you say your next door to you was burgled a few days ago.
Four houses up was burgled, but the back of me. Last Wednesday, they did a duplex upstairs. They came back Sunday, they did downstairs in the other neighbour's house. Last Friday at 6 o'clock in the evening, the guy in the high-vis that walked by and said hello to me, and then he jumped over the back wall and robbed a house at the back of me. So we're all going now with barbed wire around our houses.
Mary, the image of barbed wire and the Great Escape and all that, but what would barbed wire do?
That's what we're afraid of our life, that they're going to come in our back door.
It's no man's land, Joe. Sorry to interject.
Audrey,
yeah. It's no man's land. You can't walk around safely. I mean, you only have to look at the Lewis stop. There's always a congregation of I don't even know what to call them anymore, to be perfectly honest. Gougers, we call them. Standing there, up to no good, you know, just standing there and waiting on trouble.
And the high-vis vest seems to be the uniform of choice for the gouger.
Two questions. One, why are they wearing high-vis jackets?
Right, what they're doing is, my neighbour, she works in Woody's, and she told me that they're going in openly, robbing the high-vis gear, you know, the bottom snicker trousers, the high-vis vest, they're putting them on, walking out. So they're acting as if they're builders in the estate, and they're getting lost.
Construction workers don't wear Nike Air Max.
Anyway, they're pretending they're workmen in the area, so people are turning a blind eye. They think there's building going on. You know, there's work going on in our estate. It's a little quiet cul-de-sac. So now, every time a van, a car, we're all out taking registers. I have four cameras in my house. I have two floodlights. I've got barbed wire up, and I'm thinking, what next can I do to keep myself safe? We're terrified. As a neighbourhood, we live in a lovely, quiet cul-de-sac, but we're all terrified. We're all on a WhatsApp group. I'm reporting back and forth what's going on. Like every night of the week in the last, I'd say, 6 weeks, there's been an incident. Somebody's been robbed or we've stopped a robbery. There's not enough police force in the area, so we're kind of acting on behalf of the police.
Well, how do you know you stopped the robbery?
Because I approached a guy on Friday coming up from the shop. I said, what are you lost? He was up to no good. He let a whistle out of me and they jumped into a car, flew off. 2 days later, it's the same guy that's breaking into the house. We have all the CCTV footage. My friend was washing her dishes and there's a guy standing across, all head-to-toe high-vis. She took a picture. His mates were around the corner robbing her neighbour's house. Like, we are on the ball here 24-7. We're afraid to sleep.
You've heard of sleepless in Seattle, Joe. This is sleepless in Sagert.
But quips aside, Joe wants to hear more about how they were defending their homes.
Again, Mary, I've come back to the barbed wire around your house.
Oh, yes, I had barbed wire all around my house, don't feel safe. Now my hall door.
Yeah, I know that, but like, what did you went to? Where do you buy barbed wire?
We went to the day, about 10 of us, and we got reels and reels of barbed wire. Our houses have protected our walls.
Everything. That's the day
Some
you didn't go to work, Mary, wasn't
it? A little day off work to try and make sure my house is protected. I'm afraid to go to work.
So, you rolled out the barbed wire?
Yes, and we got some of our neighbours, we got together and they all put it up around our walls. Because the man, one of the men that was robbed Sunday evening, he came with us, the guy that was robbed last Wednesday and one on Friday. We all got together, got the barbed wire, we spent a fortune on it, and the men put it up for us.
Yeah, but is that...
It's just a little deterrent. It makes us feel a bit safer in
but
our home.
But is barbed wire, one, not dangerous to erect, and two, not dangerous to innocents?
Very, very, but guess what? It's illegal to put it up, but it's illegal for them to come near into our gardens or our homes. So I don't care. I'm protecting myself. I want to be able to lie in my bed at night.
Ooh, no messing there. That was Liveline on Wednesday. Now, how women read and who they read was explored on Arena. KCE spoke to Helen Taylor about her book, Why Women Read Fiction, The Stories of Our Lives. And she was joined in studio by writers Sinead Gleeson and Lisa McInerney, who talked about the books that had shaped them growing up. And Sinead Gleeson had a soft spot for Little Women.
It was actually the first hardback that I was ever bought by my godmother, who always pushed books in my direction. And it was one of those kind of fake leather ones with the gold trim. It looked very fancy. But I was also an only girl. So reading this kind of very sort of sisterly world, I was really envious. I was like, God, I'd love to climb into that world. But I write about it a bit, again, in Constellations, because Jo was somebody, I think everybody relates to Jo in a lot of ways. But when she cuts off her hair, because I had very short hair from when I was very young, and I was like, Jo and me, we are kindred souls with our short hair. But I really connected to it. And again, with a book, it doesn't matter if you read a book by an African writer or an American writer or an Icelandic writer. Stories are universal. And I think it's the Didion line, you know, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. It doesn't matter where they are, what century, there's something universal in all stories. And I think that I just connected to those girls and wanted to hang out with them when I first read it.
Lisa, where were you on the classics? Was it things like Pride and Prejudice and Jane Eyre, or was it Little Women?
I'll tell you what it was for me, Wuthering Heights. And I'm still really a very fierce advocate for Wuthering Heights. And one of my favourite arguments to get into are with people who kind of go, Wuthering Heights is a romance. I'm like, you're crazy. It is not in the slightest. It is a book about horrible people being hilarious. And that's how it's meant to be read. So that was for me. But of course, I was a little bit older reading that when I was very, very small. I think probably the first classics that I read would have been Heidi.
Yeah.
And Alice in Wonderland, yeah. Black Beauty. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. Mm. I was a horse for some time, I thought, in my head. So all of
me
those.
Me too.
Ones.
Absolutely. Me too.
Oh, you can't beat the classics. But Kay asked Helen Taylor about the importance of book clubs.
I think this is a way in which women are keeping fiction alive, frankly. You know, I think that the book club movement, which is overwhelmingly female, is an extraordinary phenomenon. Nobody knows how many. I try to find out how many book clubs there are and in this country, and I couldn't find out at all. But I know there are hundreds of them, and there are hundreds of literary festivals, and women flock to these things. They join book clubs, they go to literary festivals, they go on pilgrimages to Jane Austen's Chawton Cottage, to Haworth in Yorkshire. They go to Dublin, of course, to Joyce's Dublin, because women read novels by men and admire novels by men too. And I think that this gives a whole energy to fiction, and it brings people together collectively. So there is a sort of gregarious way in which, although we all read alone, of course, you can only read a book on your own, but as soon as you've read it, you want to talk about it, or you want to do something, engage with it in some way, or engage with the writer in some way. And I think women do that overwhelmingly, whereas men really don't. I mean, literary festivals, I have a quote in the book, which is one of my favourite quotes, where I talked to a steward at a literary festival, and she said that women come along and they park their men, you know, as if they were sort of in buggies or something. And then they go and collect them. You know?
Oh, I'd imagine a few men might take issue with that one, but we will park that there. Kay Sheehy asked Sinead Gleeson about issues of gender and genre.
Do you think that there's a snobbery about the kinds of books women read?
1,000,000%, for sure. I think there's an assumption made about what women write about, that, and it's been said many times that if, you know, a book by a woman is about relationships or houses or families, it's cosy, domestic, it's small. If a man writes about those things, it's global, big, political, philosophical. And I think that there's massive assumptions made about what, I mean, take for example, an incredibly talented, brilliant, best-selling author, Marion Keyes, who people have made many assumptions about her work, that it's sparkling and pink and that horrendous phase, chick lit, when Marion writes about abortion and alcoholism and
absolutely
loneliness and bereavement. All the big topics that let's
O'Brien
not forget
think of
the universal
Edna
topics.
O'Brien, you know.
However, Lisa McInerney's book, The Glorious Heresies, had been described as masculine. Explain yourself, Lisa.
The fact that it was described as masculine, I tried to remember yesterday, who did this? Was it in a review? Was it just something that was said to my face? Was it as part of an event? And I can't actually remember. So I don't know what that person was thinking or what the story is, but I have been thinking about it since. And my best bet is that it has something to do with the amount of swearing that I do, which is a bit mad because Irish women love an old swear.
A bit of judicious profanity from Lisa McInerney as heard on Irina. Here's Geraldine Mitchell reading her poem Antidote from Sunday Miscellany.
Antidote. Because wind, because rain, because skin over bone, because night worn thin, because web, because fabric, because blanket, because patchwork quilt, because stitch, 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 because love, because story, because linked arms, stout legs, because holding, because held, because graveyards so full, because with us forever, because we will not forget, because human bridge, because love, because story.
How very beautiful that was, the poem Antidote by Geraldine Mitchell, as heard on Sunday Miscellany. Now, if you looked very closely on Monday evening, you might have seen Derek Mooney lurking behind a bush here in Montrose.
Now, I recorded this on my mobile phone, so excuse the quality.
Better tomorrow.
Some big discussion. One of the managers walking by in the background, having a big discussion about whether I'm going to be sacked or not, probably.
No, they're probably saying, isn't it amazing to hear a blackbird singing in January?
Yes.
Because it's January.
Absolutely, tootly shoddy Forbes is mad for the ornithology. But in any event, blackbirds were in early song, and they weren't the only ones. Here's Éanan Ní Lonna and Richard Collins.
I heard a great tit pumping away, bicycle pumping.
Teacher.
Yeah, during the week. A great tit. Well, now, that is very odd, because the great tit is going to wait until May or something before he's going to be feeding young. It's a bit early to be worrying about it. And he picks his wife out in the flocks. He's not looking for a wife, you know. Whereas the others might be looking for a wife, advertising themselves.
But I heard a great tit too.
So what the hell is he at this early? Wouldn't he be better off fattening up and not wasting his time? The song is terribly demanding.
I know. I mean, are they not wasting their energy now doing it?
Men like to show off, don't they?
Well, it's a tricky one, because the triggering factor seems to be daylight length. The birds have clocks, and their gonads are shrunk to nothing at this time of year. They're not almost asexual coming into spring. But then the daylight length triggers the release of hormones, which bring the gonads up, and they become male and female. That's the way they work.
They become male and female?
Well,
you're telling me when a bird is born that it's not male or female at that point?
Technically, yes, but its gonads are shrunk to nothing. It's a non-sexual animal, you know. It's neutral, you know. The robin singing in winter is not sexual in any sense, do you say?
But none of us are. But we can determine whether we're male or female at birth.
Well,
in most cases.
Well, we can't. You and I have an advantage, because we have the information to create females within us, whereas poor Elena here has only the information in her genes to create. You haven't. You can't. You can only be a female.
I can always give an X chromosome. You lot can either give an X or a Y. I presume that's what you're alluding to.
Yeah, we have Adam's rib. Adam's rib confers, but the birds are the opposite.
Oh, you can't beat a bit of Richard and Éanan. That was Derek and crew on Mooney Goes Wild. Well, we're almost at a finish here on Playback, and if the birds and the bees are feeling frisky, this feels appropriate.
I'm wearing my velvet chalice.
That is it from this week's Playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.